Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Friday, April 28th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:16 p.m. Today we have present Representative Prox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, Vice Chair Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. And staff that will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records and Zach Lawhorn with the LIO. Also Jesse Logan, my staff and temporary committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today in committee we have four bills in front of us. First, we're going to bring back SB 55 from Senator Wilkowski. Then we're going to have first bill hearings on HB 166 and HB 124. To finish the meeting, we'll bring back HB 21 and discuss the remaining amendments. Starting with SB 55, we will open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify on HB 55? Doesn't look like it. And anybody online? No? Okay, we will close public testimony. Vice Chair Ruffridge, what is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move Senate Bill number 55, also known as 33-LS0347-A, be moved from committee with attached individual recommendations and fiscal notes.
Okay, without objection, SB 55 has been moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork.
No, that's just the
Representative Ruffridge.
I would move that we move Senate Bill 55, also known as 33-LS0347-B, be moved from committee with attached individual recommendations and fiscal notes. Thank you.
Okay, without objection, we move that version as well. We will take a brief at ease. Moving on to House Bill 166 from Representative Stapp. Please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is Representative Will Stapp. I represent East Fairbanks, and my staff, Clifton Coghill. Clifton, can you put yourself on the record?
Clifton Coghill, staff to Representative Stapp.
Well, thank you, Chair Sumner and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. So HB 166 is related to firefighting substances, pre and polyfluoroalkyl, otherwise known as PFAS, are a group of harmful chemicals that have adverse human health effects. They are linked to serious health conditions such as low birth rate, thyroid disease, cancer, and even at extremely small concentrations. So they also happen to make excellent ingredients in firefighting foams, in part because they resist breaking down. So when firefighting foams or other compounds contain PFAS and they seep into drinking water, these become what's known as toxic, quote, forever chemicals. And they linger around for years. So the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation declared PFAS hazardous a few years ago. House Bill 166 would look to protect Alaskans' health and prevent future pollution by effectively banning PFAS foams, if the exception would be unless federal law prohibits that. The bill also requires the state to take back small quantities of PFAS foam to ensure that it's disposed of safely and equitably, so we can ensure that we don't continue to contaminate aspects of our environment and produce adverse health outcomes for Alaskans. So there is one exemption in the bill, and that is effectively due to the nature of the threat of fires from oil and gas operations. Currently, there isn't any good substitute for PFAS foams to put out said types of fires at oil and gas terminals and those types of chemicals. So that's kind of the one aspect of the bill. And that would be within the bill's prerogative until the state fire marshal would determine some effective non-PFAS substance could do that job in lieu of still having to use the substance for those types of incidents. And now with permission of the committee, I'd like to turn to my committee aide to present the sectional analysis of the bill.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Coghill.
Through the chair, Clifford Coghill, staff for representative staff. So HB 166, section 1 in the bill, section 4603340, subsection A, everyone outside the oil and gas industry must stop using PFAS-containing foams unless the federal law preempts state law. Subsection B, people fighting fires in the oil and gas industry would basically be able to continue using PFAS until there's an alternative brought up by regulation. Subsection C, a fire marshal can determine a safe and effective PFAS-free foam for fighting oil and gas fires would be an alternate foam substitute that OSHA would nationally have to recognize, and therefore the fire marshal would have to create a new regulation for it. Subsection D, DEC must take up to 40 gallons per year of PFAS-containing firefighting foam from anywhere in Alaska. And Section 2 would be an effective date for January 1st, 2024. And that would be it.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, am I remembering correctly that the difference between this legislation and legislation last year is the legislation last year was a little broader and could have potentially included the oil industry?
Through the chair to Representative Fields, so I typically don't speak on bills that were in the legislature prior to my arrival, but yeah, there were some slight changes regarding this year's introduction in the 33rd legislature as opposed to previous years. So I'm not quite sure on the content of the exemption for oil and gas. I do know that the volume difference as far as the amount of PFAS that we are looking to kind of take back from Alaska has been changed since the previous iteration of the bill. So
could I ask the follow-up?
Go ahead.
I'm fine with, through the chair, I'm actually fine with the exclusion. I guess, put a different way, if one accepted the premise that PFAS is harmful and we should limit it, which I definitely accept that premise, what are the options that you see in terms of how to craft legislation? You've got one. I assume there are other ways of looking at it, and what led you to this form of the legislation?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Fields. I would say PFAS is going to be a serious issue for municipal communities, local communities, and of course our state, I think for a long time in the future. My argument would be this is perhaps probably the best kind of first step in an iteration of things that we might have to look for down the road. I would caution action because this is much bigger than a state of Alaska issue. It's a federal level issue. It's all over the country. PFAS contamination is not just in Fairbanks. We have lots of that because we're a fire training center in our military installations, but really big issue throughout the whole rest of the country. Obviously, I can't anticipate, say, federal action on it, but I would be very, very optimistic that you would see some sort of federal action regarding this in the future, and I would say that we should probably adjust accordingly at that time, if that makes sense.
Ask one more follow-up. That was going to be my next question through the chair. It looks like EPA has promulgated some draft regulations, and if I understand them correctly, your bill would be fine as a standalone if EPA doesn't implement the regulations. It would be complementary if EPA adopts the regulations, and if a future administration changed the EPA regulations, we would still have this as a backstop. So it seems like it's very complementary under any federal scenario. Do you think that's an accurate understanding of it?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Fields. I would say that was kind of the concept behind the design. Obviously, you know, the federal entities are subject to change. So as of this moment, I would agree with you, you know.
Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. And I guess, do we have an idea of approximately how much current PFAS use for firefighting foams is in the oil and gas industry as opposed to other sectors? I'll start there.
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, do we have any? I think we have people here that might be able to help with that.
Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, I will get back to you with that answer. I'm not sure the entire breakdown between oil and gas uses as opposed to ever different types of industry uses.
And then a follow-up. Through the chair, so that would be useful to know just in terms of how much PFAS usage for firefighting are we actually reducing with this legislation? And then I was curious as well, some of the documents here say that current firefighting alternatives are adequate for certain sectors, but not adequate for the oil and gas industry, hence the exemption. So I was wondering if that can be elaborated on a little bit.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Carrick, I kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier. So obviously due to the nature of fuel combustion, like gas and oil fires are obviously a lot different because they have combustible materials than other types of, say, forest fire standard with wood or a home fire or something like that. But I do know that I have a fire marshal in the crowd if he wants to speak to the nuances of different types of fire and firefighting substances. So,
yeah. Go ahead, Mr. Sorry, I don't know your name. Please put your name on the record.
For the record, my name is Lloyd Nakano. I'm the state fire marshal. Through the chair, Representative Carrick. Bulk storage fuel takes a lot more firefighting foam compared to maybe aircraft firefighting. You have a million-gallon tank with a surface maybe of 300 feet compared to an aircraft. So it will take a lot more, and there is nothing that is effective as a triple F at this time that can be replaced at this time.
Okay, thank you. I have a separate question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
On a different subject, through the chair, Section D has up to 40 gallons per year, trying to get that firefighting foam out for disposal, and why not set the amount at a higher standard than 40 gallons? Can you just elaborate on that particular number?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Carrick, the disposal procedures are relatively unique. Conceptually, like a lot of these places that the state is looking at reside in rural Alaska, and there's a plethora of other reasons, too. I'd be happy to provide you with a more accurate, detailed list to further satisfy the question.
Follow-up? Through the chair, you just mentioned rural Alaska. So I guess if the provision in Section D is to take up to 40 gallons, can you just elaborate a little more on how rural Alaska would be different somehow in terms of working on disposal?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Carrick. So a lot of other fire departments across the state have already kind of been looking at replacing their PFAS foams already. Some of our firefighter detachments in the interior have already done that. So this would just be to ensure that we could better facilitate areas of the state that might not have the types of resources that we have in urban Alaska, in order to ensure that we can have healthy and safe communities and try to rid ourselves of this very toxic chemical in an expedited fashion.
Okay, Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Good chair. So kind of staying with that theme of disposal, I guess what are the options for disposal currently, and is there a specific cost to that? I didn't know that notice there was not a fiscal note attached to this, so just wondering if there was a specific.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, I'm going to call Lifeline here.
Thank you. For the record, Andy Mills, Legislative Liaison and Special Assistant at the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. The fiscal note for this of substance is DOT's, and that is because Section 1 sub D refers to DEC kind of regulating, but DOT being the state that would accept for disposal. And so we wrote the fiscal note with that in mind, considering that DOT has at its airports a significant amount of PFAS, and also DOT has a contracting experience. It was deemed that DOT was one of the better entities to handle contracting for disposal of this particular substance out there. And can I elaborate on a couple of the questions earlier, just for the context of the committee? For the 40 gallons, that was actually a recommendation from us from the first iteration of the bill at 25 gallons. The reason for that is the initial justification and sort of purpose of the bill was to get at something called Project Code Red. In the backup materials for the fiscal note, you will see that Project Code Red was an initiative that was several decades long, run from federal and state grants through the Alaska Villages initiative. And they deployed Connex containers in the fiscal note. There's also a manifest of what is in those. And in each of those firefighting containers that went out to rural Alaska, there is roughly 30 gallons of in a pre-mixed container. It's called a Trimax. There's a picture also in the fiscal note of that. It's like a tank that goes behind an ATV with that pre-mixture ready for firefighting purposes. And in that Connex container is also 5 gallons of what I'm going to call PFAS-containing AFFF concentrate. That's the concentrated mixture that you would put in with some water in the 30-gallon system for firefighting purposes. So between the 5 gallons of PFAS, the 30 gallons that have PFAS contamination in it ready for firefighting, and then a little overage because there is a Trimax 3, which is like a handheld unit as well, that gets you up but just under 40 gallons, and that's how we arrived at that estimate to take a single trip out to each of these Project Code Red sites. And in here we have the list that we received from the Office of Rural Fire Protection. That's 132 villages is what we were able to identify from this list is the rough number. And then as far as the estimated cost for disposal, we did reach out, and it's in the analysis of the fiscal note here, two different contractors that we're normally working with on PFAS matters. We gave them each a methodology to try and follow. One was by mode of transportation. The other was sort of by the steps you would take. And we got two different quotes for what the total body of work would be, and we averaged those together because these will be done on a contract-by-contract, site-by-site basis. So we thought an average of those, each one being bid out, would give us the best estimate we could arrive at for disposal for each site. I'll pause there for a moment.
Representative Fields. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was actually wondering if Suzanne Cunningham is available for questions. Thank you, through the chair. It seems like a lot of the PFAS contamination at airports was from practice going out in spraying PFAS containing foams. Am I accurate in assuming that the oil and gas industry does not do that, does not conduct practice where you're spraying oil PFAS containing foams just for practice? Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chairman, Suzanne Cunningham, Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. Mr. Representative Fields, I'm not comfortable speaking for the entirety of the oil and gas industry. That is a question I can take back to the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and they can provide in written form to the committee.
If through the chair, if I could narrow it, does Alyeska Pipeline Services Company practice with PFAS-containing foams, or do you simply have them in the event of an actual emergency?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, we do not train with the foams. We use them in an actual case of an emergency.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, actually just one question. If you would like an answer from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association related to that one, I'm happy to facilitate it. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. Representative Bronx.
Yes, thank you. Through the chairman, The way I understand the bill is that PFAS-containing substances, I guess they are, could still be used to respond to a fire that originates in relation to oil, gas production, et cetera. I have personal experience. in using foam, and it works very good to prevent a fire in the event of a spill, like a gasoline tanker runs over in the ditch, turns over in the ditch, and you've got gasoline laying in the ditch. You can put foam on that and do a pretty good job of preventing that from catching fire. Do you know whether that is going to be prohibited?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, clarifying question for me, if you don't mind. Are you talking about prior to the fire actually starting?
Correct. Yes. I have had several occasions, both as a volunteer firefighter and in my former profession, to use that to prevent a fire.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Prox, I am not sure of the answer. I will. It's certainly an interesting hypothetical. When I read the text of the bill, it implies that a fire actually occurs, although you raise a really good point. In fact, you know, we would effectively not want to have a massive fire and be liable. So that's certainly interesting, thought-provoking exercise that I actually hadn't considered. So I appreciate the question.
Okay. Well, I suppose somebody has considered this, but if they haven't, think about it. In forest fire fighting, I don't know, I can't even remember. No, I guess it was called borate, a different chemical, but this is not affected, I assume, by this bill, dropping borate, whatever.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Prox, right? All PFAS-related kind of firefighting prevention chemicals would be applicable outside the one exemption written in the bill.
Yeah, and I guess why I'm kind of making a big deal of it is I was on a volunteer fire department, and I remember a couple of occasions that we sprayed foam where there was an accident, and there was gasoline laying around in the ditch, and we didn't want that to blow up while we were responding to the accident. So, and that's not in the oil and gas industry. And then there is a big safety concern if we don't have something to substitute that for fire prevention in the event of a spill in a facility. It could be a big deal. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Oh, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. My question might probably best go to the fire marshal. So I could ask the sponsor, but anticipating the lifeline setting up a flare, I'll just go right to the source. But perhaps the sponsor could ask an answer as well. So I will ask the question of either of which one of you wants to parry it. So my question to either of you gentlemen is, in the bill, there's the term firefighting substance, and there's certainly the colloquial, you know, foam is probably what people call it, but the term firefighting substance seems to be used as a term of art. So my question to the fire marshal, what is a firefighting substance? Is that a term of art that's used in your business?
For the record, Roy Nakano, State Fire Marshal, it is not. I think we can better define that. I think the oil and gas and the firefighters throughout the Alaska could define that as a better definition.
Representative Wright, I guess.
Are there any, no, through the chair. Thank you, Chair. Are there any terminologies in the industry that you could use that other states are using?
Yes, there is. I can get back with you on that. It was brought to my attention just yesterday, but I need to get more information on it.
Representative Sadler?
And I would follow up on that same line of question. I would ask the sponsor through the chair if you would have any objection to try and include any new definition, more precise definition into the bill. You know, frequently have for in this section, firefighting substance or terminology means this.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Sadler, I would certainly be in favor of ensuring that we are, when we codify something into a bill form and statute, that we're very clear about what we mean. yeah, I think the terminology firefighting substance is fairly clear to me. However, I think it can certainly be clarified so that there's really no doubt in folks' mind
what we're actually trying to get at. So,
another minor question, but you'll do it.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Thank you. Through the chair to the fire marshal, how would the fire marshal's office determine a quote safe and effective alternative? I'm not quite sure where in the process that is. A catch as catch can, or overall regulations, or on a case by case basis. Help me understand how that would be created and implemented
For an alternate firefighting substance.
Yes, sir.
We would go to like national laboratory a listed product to ensure that it meets OSHA and firefighting capabilities.
Okay. And through the follow-up, through the chair, when would that determination be made? As applications came in, or is that something you would do peremptorily, you know, in advance of everything, or where in the process? How would that be done?
Currently, right now, through the chair, Representative Sadler, I've been working with Alaska Fire Chief, and also through the airport fire chief. They've been key people that in the state that has been going down to the lower 48, and I've been tracking the AFFF PFAS replacement alternative agents.
So, Paula, so when I was trying to figure out if someone comes to you with a what they consider to be a safe and effective alternative, would you make that determination when you receive that, or is that something you would you're looking for now to try and establish as a standard before you get applications?
I would like to make sure that we have applications, but also be proactive into seeing a new agent come forward and making sure that it is effective and also environmentally safe.
So it would be your intent to, through the chair, respectfully, it would be your intent to establish standards for what safe and effective would be, and then when applications came in, they could apply that to those applications. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, sir.
And I guess I wouldn't be a fiscal note guy if I didn't ask, is there going to be much cost to do so? Or?
I can get back with you on that, sir.
Thank you very much.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, wondering, kind of in that same vein, knowing how dangerous PFAS is, obviously it sounds like it's still being used to some degree. It's going to be a disposal mechanism. It's all over the country. In other instances where there were chemicals made that are incredibly dangerous, cause horrible things, their states join lawsuits or something to help pay for the cost of the disposal of these substances. Is that an option in this case?
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, I don't really want to speak to the potential outcomes of that. I, certainly, like you referenced earlier, I would say that has happened many times in the country's history. I think there is one with asbestos and lead paint, for example. Would not be surprised if that type of incidents were to happen in the future, and definitely shows the value of statehood defense.
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, and for the fire marshal, do I understand that we have identified something that is effective or almost as effective in the event of a aircraft fire?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, they are still developing and working on that, sir.
To follow up, so in the meantime, the, what do they call them, airport firefighters will still be able to use PFAS? They'll have something.
Through the chair, Representative Prax, I think until the federal, currently right now, it's a federal regulation and not a state regulation for them to use AFFF.
And then this probably would be or Mr. Mills, through the chair, I'm wondering, the 40-gallon limit, I would think that if you have any firefighting foam concentrate, if you have any, you more than likely have considerably more than 40 gallons on hand. And what I'm getting at is, and I don't know that you would have somebody that would be, that would have the foam on hand in their inventory or storage or something that would be predisposed to try and dispose of it in a sly manner. But have you pondered that? Are there possible situations where somebody might have more than 40 gallons but would want to take the risk of disposing of it improperly?
For the record, Andy Mills, DOT, through the chair, Representative Parks. What we can quantify when we did research, so again, DOT did not have, we didn't have a history with the Code Red project before this legislation. We just happen to have, as an agency, quite a bit of PFAS firefighting from ourselves. Again, the best information we have is in the fiscal note, the manifest that gives us what was provided originally. Certainly communities out here could have additional PFAS that they have procured. They may, in some situations, the PFAS may have already spilled. And we did see from the manifest that, unfortunately, in one community, the PFAS equipment was burned up in a fire previously. There's lots of scenarios we are uncertain of in this case. What we could quantify is in this analysis that we provided on the bill, we will also say that while the intent was to target the Project Code Red communities, as it stands right now with the legislation, it does say a person domiciled in the state. And looking up that definition, it is a very broad definition in AS 0110060. A person is just about anything by definition. And so we would reasonably anticipate that although this is the goal of this is to get to the communities where the importance of getting rid of this substance without it being tossed out back, so to speak, is giving them that option and helping to take care of it to avoid the situation you're describing. The language right now with a person really is wide enough that we're not certain how far this estimate covers everything that could be contemplated, because it's there could be quite a bit more, as you state.
Mm-hmm. Follow up? Again, I'm just kind of shooting arrows here, but there might be an application for AFFF foam in the marine industry where they're carting around vessels with big, huge fuel tanks and et cetera. Have you checked into that at all?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, we internally, when we were analyzing this, did try to struggle with what scope do we put to even get to a fiscal note. We thought of marine, maritime. We thought of mining. We thought of a lot of industries, and we attempted lightly to see what organizations could we even get out to get our arms around, and we did not have an effective method to get our arms around that particular what quantity to even take into an assumption. That would be an indeterminate note that you would see in front of you. In this case, again, we quantified what we understood the intent of the legislation to be and what we could get our arms around.
Mm-hmm. Just a comment through the chair. It might be worth thinking about that. It's relatively inexpensive to dispose of firefighting foam while it's still in the can and you can haul it off. But if somebody decides to dump it on the ground, then we really have a problem. So it might be worth some further investigation to that. And it might be worth biting the bullet for the state to absorb the expense. Don't know.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, I pride to the sponsor. My understanding, really primitive terms about this bill is it says the law will say in Alaska we cannot use PFASs unless the federal government says we must. And if and when the federal government says there is a safe, effective alternative, then the state must require its use. That's my basic understanding of the bill. But my question kind of goes to the Code Red carts, and I'm sorry if this is missed. I got here at 3:30 and missed it. Does this bill mandate that the PFAS-containing foam in the Code Red carts be disposed of, or is it just when the standards change, that disposal program will take effect then? Where do we leave the code red carts after passage of this law?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Sadler. It does not just apply to the code red communities. Effectively, we're looking at all communities in the state who would no longer use, again, PFAS-related firefighting subsidies for the event of firefighting outside a certain industry, i.e. oil and gas currently. If that makes sense.
Right. But so again, so through the chair, this does not mandate the replacement or the disposal until such time as there's a safe alternative. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, if this bill were to pass, it would effectively, you know, not, it would effectively make the utilization of those substances at the effective date of the bill for any purpose outside of the exemption in the bill.
Okay. All right.
Okay, seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside. I think we will notice a amendment deadline Monday at noon, and we will take public testimony at the next meeting that we bring it up. Thank you, Representative Stapp and Mr. Coghill and everyone else that chimed in. Next, we have House Bill 124 from Representative Plume's office. Please approach the committee and put your name on the record. Begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Sumner, Vice Chair Ruffridge, and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you for hearing HB 124. For the record, I'm Julie Colomb, representative for House District 11. And with me, I have my staff, Daniel Robbins. HB 124 is a workforce bill. It makes one change to state statute. It repeals the requirement that a person hold a regular driver's license for 1 year before they apply for a commercial driver's license. The language being repealed was adopted in 1985, long before the modern commercial driver training and safety standards were established. Simply put, it is outdated and no longer reflects real-life commercial driver training. Further, it is an impediment to young people who wish to pursue training for commercial driving. Today, there are more and higher standards than ever before. The baseline for training to meet these standards is called Entry-Level Driver Training, ELDT. ELDT was put in place last year by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. In addition, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration applies the same rules to all commercial drivers in all states. FMCSA was established by Congress in 2000 to reduce crashes of commercial trucks and buses. Under the new LDT requirements, trainees are required to demonstrate a knowledge of driving and vehicle theory along with safe operating practices before they get behind the wheel. Once they pass the theory component, they can be issued a commercial driver's license learner's permit, which allows them to drive with a CDL holder in the cab. So this is a workforce bill. Right now, we are on the verge of all the IJA funding coming, the Willow Project, And already in my town in Anchorage, we're really, really short of commercial drivers. So this would help young people who are interested pursuing commercial driving training. They could get into the career faster. Also, new immigrants who want to drive a commercial vehicle could benefit and not have to wait for a year once they come into Alaska. Public and private organizations that operate commercial vehicles will benefit if more drivers are available. And ultimately, the Alaska consumer will benefit if the goods and services they depend on daily are able to move freely throughout the economy. So right now, SB 123 is a companion bill to HB 124, and that will be coming over from the Senate to the House and will likely be amended. The amendment is basically dealing with the effective date. It would become immediate. So we can deal with that once SB 123 comes over. And I can turn it over to my staff to do the short sectional
summary, or we also have invested testifiers, whatever the chair would like to do.
Would you go ahead, Mr. Robbins?
For the record, my name is Daniel Robbins, staff to Representative Cologne, and I will read the sectional. Section 1 amends Alaska Statute 2833.100A to remove subsection 2, which requires an applicant for a commercial driver's license to have held a regular driver's license for at least 1 year before beginning the CDL certification process. Section 2 sets January 20, 2024 as the effective date.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins. And I see we have online Joey Crum for invited testimony. Mr. Crum, if you can hear me, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick audio check. Can you hear me well?
We can hear you. Maybe speak up just a little bit, though.
Okay. I will use my instructor voice. Is this better?
A little bit.
Okay. For the record, my name is Joey Crum, and I am the president and CEO of Northern Industrial Training, commonly known as NIT. At NIT, we train people to go to work. We're workforce development specialists. We work with communities, employers, and economists to forecast what is going to be needed to prepare local forecasts for the upcoming opportunities. One of our strongest programs is training and preparing people to drive commercial vehicles. People from all over the state come to our facilities in Palmer or Fairbanks to attend our program. But we also train drivers statewide, including there in Juneau in partnership with Plinkett Haida and in places like Kotzebue and Yuktiagvik. When you work with as many people as we do, you see patterns in flow. You see the flow of people thinking about what they want to do and selecting the careers and the pathways that help get them to achievement of their goal. In that flow, you also see barriers. They really stand out, like a boulder in a stream damming the most efficient path for water. I think that's a good way to look at this bill. House Bill 124 removes a barrier and allows for more efficient training flow. We see a lot of young people who are interested in jobs that require CDL lose interest because of the current statute. Now, passing House Bill 124 isn't going to show up on the Richter scale or move the earth, but it is necessary and will help people, especially those adversely affected in rural Alaska. HB 124 removes an outdated barrier by removing the one-year requirement of having a regular driver's license before someone can test for a CDL. New federal rules and safety standards implemented on February 7th of 2022 make the current statute moot. The new regulations called ELDC, or Entry Level Driver Training, require additional levels of screening, performance verification, and training. The process to get a CDL now requires a person pass a written DMV exam and then a DOT physical to be in hand to get a CDL permit. They then must pass written exams proctored by a federally registered training provider that cover dozens of topics. Then the person must pass a practical performance verification given by a federally registered training provider. And then finally, they must pass a DMV proctored practical exam. There are many levels of performance, both knowledge and practical, baked into the process of getting a CDL. It is important to note that vehicles such as 16-passenger vans or pickup hauling hazmat, like 120 gallons of diesel, require CDLs to drive. We need to pass this bill to remove unnecessary barriers to keep people from gainful employment. I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman, but I'll remain on the line, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Crum. Looks like we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Crum, is there any could you remind me again when the ELDT standard was imposed?
It went into effect on February 7th of 2022.
Okay, so my follow-up question is there any data, through the chair, Mr. Crum, any data as to whether the given just about a year and a couple of months, if any record, any data as to whether this has improved driver safety performance?
None that has been published.
Okay. and recognizing that a year is not a very long time when it comes to data collection, but thought I would ask. Okay, thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Crum. You know, when I travel out of state, I definitely see some different driving behaviors compared to in Alaska. People tend to drive at a much higher rate of speed. They follow a little more closely on the highways. And so my question to you is what driving conditions, training for Alaska-specific winter conditions and highway conditions are undertaken for someone getting a CDL in Alaska, perhaps above and beyond national standards? In other words, what practices does Alaska undertake to ensure a strong practical experience beyond CDL training to ensure folks are ready to drive commercially under these conditions?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, the CDL is defined as a federal license. The standards that must be met in order to receive a CDL are determined at the federal level. The state hasn't imposed any additional driving tech driver training. For example, if I live in South Florida and I get a CDL and I am a truck driver there, by federal law, if I bring that CDL to Alaska, it counts as something that allows me to drive here. So the best benefit that I could say is that Alaska trainers, those that are federally approved, will be teaching the techniques in the environment people are going to drive, which is another reason why we need this bill passed. Because somebody from Florida can come here right now. We want to be able to train our own as soon as possible to safely enter this industry. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Crum. Next we have Joe Michelle. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Joe Michelle. I'm with the Alaska Trucking Association. The Alaska Trucking Association and the transportation industry fully supports HB 124. There's not much
Mr.
more.
Mr. Michelle, could you speak up a little bit? We're having a little bit of trouble hearing you. Thank you.
The Alaska Trucking Association and the transportation industry fully supports HB 124. There's not much more I could say that Mr. Crum and Representative Kalum have not already covered. So in the interest of time, I will just say that we fully support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Michelle, I guess I'll ask the same question I asked Mr. Crum briefly. Do you have any data or even a gut feeling as to whether the new ELDT standards are resulting in safer commercial drivers in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, no data has been published in regards to ELDT improving driver safety as of this moment in time, but I would bring up the point that before entry-level driver training, there was no minimum requirements. A individual would just be have to pass a, you know, a permit, a medical card exam, and a driving test, and they'd be on the road. So it's definitely much more stringent of a process to get a CDL than it was a year and a half ago.
Go ahead.
In follow-up, Mr. Michelle, both you and Mr. Crum used the same precise language, no data yet published. Leads me to think, is there data collected but not yet published, or is there any reason for the similar terminology used? Yeah, I'm pins and needles here.
To the chair, Representative Sadler, FMCSA is in the process of collecting data, and all states are required to submit road crash data to federal regulators. So as the required reporting requirements, I apologize for redundancy, starts to come out, we will be able to see it, but it's just moving at the speed of federal government right now as far as data collection goes.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Next, we have Tatiana Robbins. Go ahead, Mrs. Robbins. You can put your name on the record.
Hello.
Your presentation.
Hello. My name is Tatiana Robbins. I live in Anchorage. Thank you, Chairman Sumner and members of Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm here to urge your support for SB 124. I am CEO of Ukraine Relief Program. Our program, since May, provided transportation and support for over 1,000 Ukrainians who have fled the war in Ukraine. Our clients came here to Alaska simply because they want to stay alive. As we help them with housing and immediate needs, we're right now in a very important phase of our operation. We're employing them right now. And as we learn about professional skills of our clients, we discovered that we have a really large number of our program participants that have experience with driving heavy equipment, buses, and public and private, and they already hold CPCs in Europe and Ukraine and would like to continue in that field. We were really, really excited to learn that we have over 500 positions available for those who might hold CDLs, but because Alaska statutes are out of sync with the federal requirements to get CDL, our Ukrainians have to wait a year before they can apply for CDL, which I afraid will force them to other industries because they still have to support their families, or they will simply will leave our state and they'll go to states where they don't have to wait for a year, which we would hate to see because a lot of we have a lot of very good professional skilled people who would like to continue in that field. I believe that passage of SB 124 will help to fill much needed vacancies in the transportation industry and will help to many of our rivals to be able to work in their chosen field and begin to rebuild their lives in Alaska. And I urge committee to pass SB 124. It will help our Ukrainians to work and will help our Alaska growing. I'm here to answer any of your questions, and please let me know if you have questions.
Okay, thank you, Mrs. Robbins. I think we will go ahead and open public testimony on HB 124. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify on HB 124?
To the chair, may I testify?
Go ahead, Mr. Robbins.
For the record, my name is Daniel Robbins, staff to Representative Cologne, and I would like to just say that my mom, who you just heard, and I are both Ukrainian immigrants, and we have come across many of the immigrants that have come to Alaska since the start of the war, and I could tell you that they are definitely eager to work, and that some of them have held jobs such as truck driving back in Ukraine, and that they would love to do that, but that this rule, this one-year requirement, does get in the way of them being able to start working and get their CDL. So I definitely do support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins. Anybody else? No? Well, we will go online. I don't see anybody, so we will close public testimony, and we will take a brief at ease. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I would move that we move House Bill number 124, also known as 33-LS0588/A. From committee with attached recommendations, individual recommendations, and fiscal notes.
Okay, seeing no objection, House Bill 124 has been moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to transition. Thank you. One and the remaining amendments that we rolled over from last week. We stopped on amendment number two from Representative Fields. Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Happy to just summarize this amendment. There had been some discussion on it. Amendment number two would delete the ability to access or raid the state public education fund to pay for the cost of onboarding new payer groups. And what that would mean in effect is if a new payer group was bringing in its reserve sufficient pay the first 4 months of getting onboarded with AlaskaCare, then that a group like that could. If there was a group that, say, had no reserves and was potentially very high cost, that might make it infeasible for that new group to come in. So the way I see it is, I think Representative Prox described it pretty well. It makes the bill a little more fiscally conservative and ensures that we can still accept groups if they have some reserves to pay for the transition, but we don't expose ourselves to up to $100 million in exposure in the public education trust. One of the things that came out of discussion last time that was important is that the underlying bill actually allows employee groups beyond school districts to participate, and I don't think it's appropriate to be sort of raiding the public education fund to subsidize a group of, say, non-school employees from a locality. Maybe there's a better way of supporting that locality, but I don't want to endanger the public education fund. Thank you.
Okay. And I don't recall, was there objection to amendment number two?
Objection.
Okay. So Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'll speak to my objection. Yeah, I would take gentle exception to the multiple references I heard to being this amendment trying to prevent a raid on the public education fund. I think that's an entirely appropriate use for the education fund to pay the cost of education, which we are told many times includes salaries and benefits and the well-being of teachers and employees. And so I think this is an appropriate use of the higher education fund. It is a may, it's not a shall, it's a backstop, should the circumstances envisioned by the bill not take place. And so I think it's a reasonable thing to have. And again, it's not a raid, it's not a permanent deduction. It is a reduction for a few years until it's paid back over 10 years. So it's just a short-term loan. So I will maintain my objection to the amendment.
Okay. Representative Wright.
I'd like to hear the thoughts of the bill sponsor.
Representative Vance, if you would, please.
For the record, this is Representative Sarah Vance of House District 6. Through the chair, Representative Wright, I believe that this amendment would be detrimental to the bill because it allows only school districts the ability to onboard and have the flexibility of utilizing the public health, the public education fund for policies of self-insurance only if they needed the use of those funds. And they are required to pay that back under the course of no more than 10 years. And without that ability to utilize the public education fund, it would put more strain on the current fund, the health fund that the current state employees contribute to for Alaska Care.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, for the record, Jake Almeida, Chief of Staff to Rep Vance, I believe this was distributed to members. I don't know for sure, but we asked the Department of Administration a number of questions regarding the bill, and we asked about the removal of Section 3. And the question was, why does the Department of Administration need Section 3 if the overall idea of the bill could be successful without it? And their answer was, and I quote, if HB 21 passes without Section 3 and groups enter the Alaska Care Plan and increase the plan's costs, it is possible the Alaska Care Fund, called the Group Health and Life Fund, will not have enough funds to pay employee member claims. As the department understands Section 3, it appears to be intended to provide financial protection to the state, to the plans, for an incoming group that may incur significant claims within the first 4 months that the Alaska Care Reserves are not prepared to absorb. So it is a temporary solution. It is not a rating of the fund, and that is how the department interprets that section that is necessary of this bill, Section 3.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to note the bill as written actually mandates that the department onboard these groups. I do have a subsequent amendment to make that a may, but if this amendment passed and the subsequent May amendment passed, it would protect the department. This is only, quote, necessary insofar as you were onboarding a group that might be very expensive to the state, which I would argue potentially we shouldn't be doing that. But that is, it's necessary to sort of, I would say, clean up this bill and using multiple steps. Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, I know Section 3 has certainly caused a little bit of question marks for folks. So one of the questions I had and in the response that we received by email was in regards to the fund itself, as well as the dollar amount. And the email back from the individual we had online last time had mentioned that that those well, first, that the dollar amount was not set by the Department of Administration. And so I'd like some clarification as to the dollar amount itself. And then the fund that was chosen, which I guess I think I understand what Representative Sadler is saying, you know, what other fund would it be? But $100 million certainly sounds like a lot. And I was wondering if we could get clarification on the choice of that number.
Vice Chair Ruffridge, I was not able to get an answer of the origination of that number, but the Department of Administration did say that they are comfortable with that number because, as mentioned before, there have been instances of some claims up to three and prescriptions up to $3 million at a time. And so they don't feel that the $100 million is out of the ordinary for a group. That is beyond my wheelhouse, but we should have someone from the department online to talk about the ballpark. But as far as the dollar figure, I would put that to the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, if I might again, Jake Almeida for the record, in the email from DOA again, they did say the first part of what the representative said, and then they did add, it is not unheard of for the Alaska Care Plan to experience single pharmacy prescriptions in an amount of $3 million per prescription. Given the escalating nature of healthcare costs, $100 million is not an excessive amount that might be needed should the bill become law.
Representative Ruffridge, would you like to talk about prescription costs?
Thank you. Through the chair, I dispense a lot of prescriptions in my day, and I have yet to see one that costs $3 million. So I would certainly love to note what that is that the department is currently paying for that costs $3 million, because that might be a question for another committee. However, if this takes 4 months to onboard, the department is thinking that they could incur costs to pay claims of $100 million in 4 months, because that, I'm just going to say that seems outlandish.
And we also have Andrea Musa from the Division of Retirement and Benefits and Patrick Shire from Pacific Health Coalition who appears online for questions. So, was that to the?
Yeah, department? It could be to anyone that is willing to answer.
Andrea, yeah, sorry. Can you please put your name on the record and address the?
Yes, through the chair. This is Andrea Moyta, and I'm with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And to Senator Ruffridge's point, we do have very specialized drugs that can cost upwards of $3 million, and those are a lifetime curing drug for muscular sclerosis or whatever. I forgot what that word is, but we definitely have spent that, and it was through the employee plan in 2022, I believe. So it is not unheard of, although I do want to point out that we did not come up with $100 million, and so we would definitely be open to suggestions from the bill sponsor.
Can I follow up? Thank you. And through the chair, I appreciate that answer. And certainly aware that there are expensive medications that are there. But a $3 million treatment is not really the norm and should not be what we build into a potential for claim payments for 4 months. What I guess would be the average claim payment? I mean, you guys have a lot of folks that are insured. What would be your mean payment per person in the plan currently for a month's worth of care?
Through the chair, this is Andrea Moyka. I do not have those numbers off the top of my head, but I am happy to get those back to you.
Okay, thank you.
I actually have a question. So would this be $100 million per school district or per group that joined? Because it sort of, that would be my question.
Mr. Chairman, the bill specifies total expenditures.
Well, it says, okay.
Page 4, line 26, total expenditures from the public education fund under C of this section may not exceed $100 million.
Okay, well, certainly we put on the record that that is definitely the intent. Representative Fields?
Through the chair, to someone who may know the answer, how much money is in the public education fund right now? Follow up might be a good number to know. I assume that fund earns a return. I guess that question is for the bill sponsor, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, my apologies. I failed to get the fund balance for the public education fund at this time.
Okay. Through the chair, let's just assume for a second without knowing for sure that the fund returns what some other funds under a POMV structure return. So let's say it costs, I don't know, $100 million to bring on some new employee groups and they repay 10 years later after we've lost 5% annually for 10 years. Is it your intent under the bill that the school districts have to repay sort of lost earnings or just the money that was originally lent out? Because you, under a POMV structure, you have the potential to lose a significant amount of revenue with a sort of interest-free 10-year loan.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, the bill on page 4, line 19, says that they must pay the claims submitted by district employees. And then in the next section, it says that they reimburse the public education fund for the money expended.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I guess I would just note not the lost earnings that would then be used for public education. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Seiler, you maintain your objection?
I do.
Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Prox.
Pass.
Representative Ruffridge.
Oh, jeez. Pass.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Wright.
No.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
No.
Representative Ruffridge.
No.
Chair Sumner.
No. And so with two yeas and five nays, amendment number 2 has failed. Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. Amendment number 3 by Representative Fields.
I'll move amendment 3.
Okay. Objection.
There's objection. Representative Fields?
I'm not offering amendments 3 and 4.
Okay, amendment number 3 has been withdrawn. Amendment number 4 will not be offered.
I'll move amendment 5.
Okay. Without objection.
Objection. Sorry, flipping some pages.
Representative Fields?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in the bill actually requires DOA to accept new groups regardless of impact in terms of costs on Alaska Care, therefore costs on the state as a whole. That is inconsistent with current law. Amendment number 5 would change shall to may, giving the administration the ability to do an actuarial analysis, figure out what the costs on Alaska Care as a whole is going to be, and basically, you know, admit a group if it's in the best interest of the state. And should there be a group that, say, has poor plan experience and very high costs, DOA would have the ability to say, you know what, this is actually not in our best interest.
Okay. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer the sponsor of the bill the opportunity to give her thoughts on amendment number 5.
Representative Vance?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Sadler. I believe that the intent of this legislation was to aid school districts, especially smaller ones who are struggling with the health care costs. And it would be a detrimental policy from the state's perspective to be able to deny one school district over another and create a situation of discrimination and feel that this amendment would just not put our best foot forward of ensuring that we are providing for the best possible health care for our education.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Brief follow-up, if I may. Through the chair, to the sponsor, Representative Vance, what might be the effect of this option? The Amendment 5 would make it a main on a shell. What might be the effect of this on the size of the ultimate insurance pool from which claims for state employees and school district, university, other polysubs might be?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it's hard to determine the full impact of this, but the idea is that the larger the pool, the likelihood of cost going down. And so, yes, there are going to be some users who have higher use and higher cost than others, but the larger the pool, that kind of spreads out the cost over the magnitude of the users and may end up being a neutral impact. It's hard to tell at this point, but I think from a policy perspective, my intent with this legislation is that we are open to every school district and do not turn anyone away who may be seeking aid in the area of lowering their health care costs.
Thank you.
Representative Fields?
Thanks. I just a reminder that this bill actually affects employees far beyond school districts. In the title of the bill, it says, an act relating to group insurance coverage and self-insurance coverage for school district employees, employees of the University of Alaska, and employees of other governmental units in the state. And where it references employees of other governmental units in the state is on page 6. And the language that the bill adds reads on line 26, or other participating governmental unit. Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Sadler.
Which is exactly why I've referenced school districts or the university or other public subs. So, yes, I acknowledge that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Vance.
I would just like to clarify the amendment is directly on page 5, line 3, and that is under the section that deals specifically with university and school district employee health insurance, not that of municipalities. So this would just be changing the word may impacting the school health care plans.
Okay, Representative Sadler, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
Please call the roll on Amendment Number 5.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
No.
Representative Ruffridge.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Wright.
No.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Chair Sumner.
No. And so with 2 yeas and 5 nays, Amendment Number 5 is failed. There is Amendment Number 6, Representative Fields.
Mr. Chairman, I think this bill is so poorly thought out and so dangerous to the state financially, there's no point in continuing with the farce of offering amendments, so I will not be offering further amendments. I would just note that this bill puts $100 million at risk in the public education fund to fund random other groups of employees. I don't know how that's defensible. It's clearly the due diligence has not been done on this bill, but I don't see any point in wasting anyone else's time on a Friday afternoon.
Okay, so amendment number 6 will not be offered. Here's amendment number 7 will not be offered. Amendment number 8 will not be offered. Amendment number 9 by Representative Carrick.
I'll move amendment number 9.
Okay, without objection, amendment number 9 has passed.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm reading through the amendment sheets. I wonder if I could ask your indulgence to flip to amendment 9.
We are past amendment number 9. Representative Sadler, unless you would like to move to rescind action.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move that we rescind action in approving amendment number 9 without objection.
Okay. Seeing no objection, action has been rescinded on amendment number 9. Amendment number 9 is before us. Is there objection?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I object.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. I don't object to rescission because I do appreciate an opportunity to describe the amendment for the committee. Amendment number 9 simply takes out employees of the University of Alaska from House Bill 21 for a number of reasons. One is, I think, getting to Representative Field's concerns. I share those concerns that this legislation, the underlying bill, has great potential for unintended fiscal consequences and potentially could destabilize the public education fund. The University of Alaska does not take a position on this legislation. However, I want to note for the committee that currently the University of Alaska offers all employees, including staff and faculty, a choice of 3 healthcare plan options, which were recently renegotiated, and are available to staff and faculty. Also, the current average enrollment for faculty and staff who are on insurance at the University of Alaska is 3,041 employees as of recently in 2023. So essentially, I just believe that the way we do business with the University of Alaska is fundamentally somewhat unique and different from the way that school districts and other governmental units, which we don't know exactly what all those governmental units would entail, but fundamentally a bit different from the other entities described in this bill. And additionally, the University of Alaska employs such a large number of people that were the university to enroll in AlaskaCare, the potential for destabilization of the public education fund would be particularly perverse. So just in consideration of the many fiscal unknowns and the fact that the University of Alaska is pleased with their insurance coverage at the moment, I would ask that we exempt the university from this legislation.
Okay, Representative Prox.
Through the chair, interesting thought, but the university has the option under this bill to not enroll. Is that correct through the chair to the sponsor?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, you are correct. This is merely allowing the option for the university to enroll under the AlaskaCare plan should they need to do so if it does improve the cost and benefit of their healthcare outcomes. It's merely a tool for the future if needed.
So it's just a comment then. I'm and please respond if this generates a response. I'm not seeing the point of this of preventing taking a choice away from the university. They have the choice. If the bill should pass, they would have the choice to not participate. But if they took a look at it and all of a sudden thought, whoops, I want to join, they would be precluded from joining if it did work out for their benefit.
Through the chair to...
Go ahead, Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Prox. In this instance, I'm less concerned about the impact on the University of Alaska employees than I am on the stabilization of the public education fund and of all the employees utilizing AlaskaCare. It's unclear with this legislation overall whether the state or the participants in the insurance plans would potentially take on increased costs for health insurance. And in the event that the University of Alaska, as a much larger entity than some of the other entities described with this legislation, were to join, that would be upwards of 3,000 employees who could potentially have very strong and immediate detrimental impacts on all recipients of AlaskaCare. I just fundamentally believe the University of Alaska is somewhat of a different agency and entity, especially in terms of negotiation. The University of Alaska faculty union organization has been successful in the past at negotiating very reasonable health care plans for their employees, but they too tend to be more expensive than other groups. And so for those reasons, I just am concerned about the overall health of the public education fund and of the potential unintended consequences to AlaskaCare employees.
Thank you. That I wasn't listening loud enough when you said that the first time. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do hear the maker of the motion's view that university employees are, I think you said, somewhat unique. I would argue that as public employees, they are no more or less unique than any other public employee. And that you said there might be a risk if there being additional costs, I think, to university employees who are unique. But one thing we can be sure of is that health costs rise for public employees in Alaska. I don't think I've ever seen them go down. When I've gone door to door, I've heard people say, why do we, they propose structural questions. Why do we have so many school districts? Why do you have so many individual insurance plans? Why do you have so many different health insurance options? I see this bill, far from being a farce, as being a significant tool for bringing some structural reforms to the state's expenses. It's a way to bring some economies of scale to the question of education costs and political subdivision costs. These are two of the largest components of our state budget, health insurance and education. So I applaud this the sponsor for bringing these methods through. And I think change is difficult, but this general strategy, I think, is something we need to envision and need to take the bull by the horns and actually implement this if we are going to achieve some structural improvements in our state fiscal situation and meet the needs of employees of the university, school districts, of state government, et cetera, who rely on the backstop of the state of Alaska in its pockets, including the higher education fund, to provide health insurance.
Okay. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, just comment on the amendment. Representative Sadler makes a point. And we do, the whole thing, unfortunately, depends on information that isn't available to us. And so we're making some guesses at this point. But we need to get the actuarial. We should, I think it might work out better to pass the bill on as it was intended, having changed it previously. But I think we might as well leave the bill as is intended, minimal amendments from this point, and then we have another bite at the apple if it gets to the floor.
Brief at ease. Number nine, Representative Sadler, you maintain your objection?
I do.
Okay, please call the roll on amendment number nine.
Representative Carey.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
No, thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Wright.
No.
Chair Sumner.
No. And so with two yeas and five nays, amendment number nine has failed.
Briefities.
Briefities. I think we will set House Bill 21 aside, and we will adjourn for the day. The time is, for the record, the time is 4:51 p.m.